Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we record oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, October 4th, 2019, is Robert Williams, also known as Rocket Williams. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thanks for joining us. Before we begin, could you please provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career?
Yes, I started with the Department of Corrections in January of 1986. I retired in April of 2016. So I had a 30-year career with the Department of Corrections.
Wow, and was that all? I'm sorry.
I started as a correction officer one, and I retired as a correction officer three, lieutenant.
Okay, was that all at SCI Camp Hill?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And now, tell me why they call you Rocket.
I got the Rocket name earlier in my career due to my enforcement of discipline and the backing up of correctional staff at the facility.
Okay.
I just happened to be on the spot for a lot of incidents.
Ah, okay.
I mean, how'd you get here so fast? I was here when it started.
There you go. Okay. All right. Well, let me set you up for this discussion, which is about the Camp Hill riot. It is around 2:33 p.m. on Wednesday, October 25th, 1989. Where are you and what is happening?
All right. On that day, it was my day off. But about 2:40 or so, I got a call from the shift lieutenant, Lieutenant Wolf, advising me I've been activated as a member of the CERT team and to respond to the facility immediately. So I proceeded to the facility. I was there by about 3 o'clock. I was directed to the rear gate where I met up with the other CERT members. And we rallied in the Sally Port, the rear gate Sally Port. And then we were waiting for instructions on what we were to do.
Okay, so tell me up to this point what CERT was like at the prison. What kind of training did you receive up to that point?
All right. I was on the team about 2 years at this point, and all we had was surplus gear and equipment. We had used surplus vests from the military, a couple of batons, a little bit of chemicals, and not much of a battle plan.
So essentially your training was, here's some used equipment, and get ready to do whatever we tell you, although we don't really train you on what to do.
That's correct. Somebody's in charge, do what they tell you.
Okay. All right, so you're inside the Sally Port, rear gate, and you're all forming up. What are your orders? What happens next?
All right, so we're standing by the rear gate. The CERT team at the time was probably a 40-man team, with everybody assembled in one location. So currently, as we're standing in the Sally Port, we have about eight people. Eight people that have the courage to respond to an incident like this.
Okay.
That's
not very many people.
For one squad.
Okay. So what were you seeing? What was going on around you or in front of you?
The riot was pre-forecast. This is the third riot of the year or in the month. You know, we followed Pittsburgh, we followed Huntington, and it was our turn. So a smart staff member would stay home that day.
Okay.
Well, as you know, I came here, I responded, but smart staff member, if he got out of the facility that day or any of the other days, he would be wise to go home.
Okay. And at this time, things are on fire in the group 2 and 3 part of the institution?
Yes, the 2 and 3 facility side of the facility is on fire, and we've elected...
So you were talking about the fact that you had evacuated the modular trailers that were in the institution.
Correct.
And where...
That wasn't too much related to the incident going on the other side of the facility.
Where did you evacuate those inmates to?
Put them on the main stockade field.
Okay. And then was the rest of your time spent just kind of...
Then as a team, we moved up to where the E-Gate Tower is there.
Uh-huh.
And then we just manned that spot there. And the inmates were there hurtling rocks and stuff at us.
Mm-hmm.
The guy on my left to me, who was John Fisher, he got taken out by a rock to the chest. Again, we're only 8 men.
Wow.
So he got hit in the chest with a rock. And the guy on my right, Jose Enriquez, he got taken out by an orange came flying over the fence, bounced off the ground, and hit him in the groin.
Mm.
But you're standing there, and, you know, the SERP team members are being taken out by thrown objects. And then the sad part is, that's when they brought the, this was the first day, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
They brought the staff, down in front of the kitchen and tortured them in front of us. Staff officers down in front of the kitchen and torture them. As we were standing there.
I had interviewed some other people that were saying really all you could do was just stand there and scream at them to stop. But on the other side of that fence, you had hundreds and hundreds of inmates.
That was the fact, and it's very difficult to say you didn't have the courage to go get them.
But, you know, had you gone in, you could have ended up being a hostage as well.
If we went in as men, the inmates, they're not men, they're cowards.
Right.
They would have scattered. That's the sad fact.
And this went on till probably, 11 or 12 p.m. that night?
Yeah. Yes, it did.
And then what happened?
We're still on the first day. Somehow they negotiated a peaceful resolution. And I might have my dates mixed up.
I think you're right.
I'm referring to the second day. The first day we secured that we took the inmates out of their trailers, put them in there, and then we let the hostage negotiation team resolve the incident. So the SERP team wasn't used on the first day.
Mm-hmm. So on that first night, while you're standing there at the E-Gate, Jerry Kostelak and a couple other people are stuck up on the roof.
Yes, in the gym.
So you must have seen, you were right there, so you must have seen how they were rescued.
I know he was in the area. I don't recall him specifically.
Okay. I know.
I do know him. And I knew the officer with him. I don't know if it was Officer Basker was with him. I'm not sure who was with him up there.
And then they brought in a fire truck and put up a ladder and had them come down the ladder.
Possibility, I can't recall. I don't remember the fire truck coming in. Because
mm-hmm.
what the inmates did, that we put on the main field that weren't involved in the riot, they set a shed on fire underneath the tower to burn the officer out of the tower. So we had to bring a fire truck in for that, to put out the fire. And as long as he was there, we could use the ladder to get them off the window or off the roof wherever they were at.
Right. And then, so they did the negotiations, and the inmates then were returned to their cells.
Yes.
And then, I guess, what happened after that?
I went home, and then I came in the next day on the 2 to 10 shift. So I was a 2 to 10 officer.
Oh.
Not a 6.
All right, so let me set you up for that night then. It's around 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, October 26th. Where are you and what's happening?
All right. I'm assigned to E Block in Group 2 and 3 side of the facility, which is the side that just had the disturbance the day before.
Yes.
I'm on E Block. And we're there. And I got there and... usually when you relieve the shift in front of you, they tell you what the count is, do a control of the keys, let you know what's going on for the day. So at the briefing, we haven't got the keys back from yesterday, so the doors aren't locked, the cell doors aren't locked, All we had to do, 6 to 2, we had to feed them and make sure medical was here. So I believe that's what our briefing was. We're going to feed them a meal and address any medical issues they have. And slowly we'll try to find the keys to the unit so we can lock all the doors.
Wow.
Well, actually, they disabled the locks above the doors. So the appropriate response would have been to put a chain and a padlock on each door. But here by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they haven't even considered that option, I don't believe. And we had 6 cell blocks, so that would have been a massive undertaking to have a chain and a lock for every door with 6 cell blocks.
So they didn't put chains and locks on the doors?
They did not.
And so, go ahead.
So the panel, above the cell door, there was called a rod box, which holds the internal lockings of the mechanisms. Well, the inmates on the first day of the riot took the covers off the rod boxes, so they had direct exposure to the locking mechanism just by reaching out their cell door, reaching up above their head there, and hitting the lever themselves to lock the door.
And normally that would be controlled at the end of the block in the switch box with the levers,
yeah.
Right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep, there should only be one spot where you can open the door, or 2 spots, one manually at the key, at the door itself, and the second one up front, which is what we used all the time.
So there you are, you're sitting in the block, and you can hear the inmates leaving themselves in and out of cells?
Oh, no, for the first couple hours of the day, they were pretty, they were vocal. They were yelling how they just kicked our ass, and if things don't change, they're going to kick our ass again. But, you know, you go down the tier, you do your job, you address any issues, and, you know, you ask for your keys back. Anybody got the keys? Anybody got the cell block keys down here? I'm like I'm speaking to you now. I used humor throughout my career. Come on, one of you guys must have the keys.
Oh, my.
You didn't get the keys. Okay, so, you know, it was a pretty tense couple of 4 hours, but then the 6 o'clock news came on.
Yes.
Okay? It's a population prison. Every inmate has 2 TVs in their cell. So you just stand at a cell door and you want to know what happened at the Camp Hill prison, because it's going to be on the nightly news. Correct?
Yes.
You agree with that, right?
Yes.
So we're standing at a cell door along with the other inmates, and everybody's quiet for the 6 to 7 o'clock news because they want to hear how'd we do? Well, the inmates want to report. So, on the 6 o'clock news, there was a disturbance at the Camp Hill prison yesterday. A few staff were beat up, blah, 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 blah. And here's the superintendent of corrections going to give you an overview. Live news now. And the superintendent says, the deal I made with the inmates yesterday, I'm taking all that back.
Oh.
On the news. 6 o'clock news, out front. He was out front of his office there. Yesterday we had a disturbance here. I made a deal with the inmates to reverse some policies. And today I'm telling you, but I'm not honoring that deal.
Wow.
That was a live news broadcast. So you can look that up yourself.
Yeah.
So, like my mouth dropped, hit the floor, bang. Oh, the inmates in the cell I was watching TV with, their mouth hit the floor. I go, damn. So then the inmates waited till the 7 o'clock news came on, 6:30 news. This is Camp Hill riot, Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, a few things happened, blah, blah, blah. After the news came out, 7 o'clock, they all came out at once. So you're standing on the tier, they threw water up on the lights of the cell block. They had light bulbs on the cell block. They took a cold cup of water. They threw water on the bulb. The bulb exploded. The lights went out. They turned their cell lights out, and they stepped out at 7 o'clock, about 7:05, about 5 or 6 cell blocks reported the same thing. The area lieutenant Reniger, immediately orders evacuation to all his 6 cell blocks down to the E-Gate Tower. All staff report to the E-Gate Tower because he knows none of the 6 cell blocks are secure. He came on 2 o'clock with us. The area lieutenant knows his cell blocks are not secure. His staff were in danger. He's watching the news somewhere also. So we meet down at the EK Tower. You try to lock the doors. You evacuate the block as best you can. You hope you brought everybody with you. On my side, we had no lock to the front door. So you call down the lieutenant. He had a key to the front door. Send somebody up so we could at least lock the front doors. The inmates, we can't keep them in the building. Or we can't keep them in their cells, but we can at least try to keep them in the buildings. But the officer never got there in time. Locked six cell doors. Or six cell blocks up. And the inmates busted out onto the area in front there. I believe five of the cell block staff made it to the E-Gate Tower. One cell block didn't make it.
Right.
And this is very difficult for. So when you're working in a facility that you know is going to explode someday, you make some commitments with other staff. You won't leave me. I won't leave you. No, because you got wives and kids at home. You got young children. So I made a commitment to Mr. Eckenberg. I won't leave him. He was on K Block at the time, and I was on E. And he's one of the staff that didn't make it down to the gate.
Right.
So we're all standing at the gate there, you know, trying to get all the staff down there. But, you know, unfortunately, two of them didn't make it. Then the inmates broke through the gate and chased the rest of us across the facility over to the key room. So now you're locked in the key room. About 20 staff had just ran completely across the facility with inmates chasing them. And you go. And the inmates started throwing Molotov cocktails they smashed out the glass in the offices around the control desk and threw Molotov cocktails in at us. So what are you going to do? You either going to die in that building? Are you going to become Robert Williams and open that fuck to the front door? Get up there and kick some ass. So, text all of them. I said, Rocket Williams, get up here. I'm gonna open this fucking front door. You get the fuck out of here, and you get to the fucking main gate and get us some weapons. Aye, aye, Captain. At the time, I was a black belt in jiu-jitsu karate. That's why they called me Rocket Williams. I ran out to the main gate, dodging all them inmates. I got to the armory. I got me a shotgun. I got me about 30 rounds of ammunition. I came back to the main gate. By that time, the inmates had complete control of the area. I saw some brave staff members dressed in inmate uniforms being led out the gate to the gate by inmates. Inmates dressed staff that they liked in inmate uniforms and escorted them to the main gate where I was able to identify my staff members. Sergeant Beck was at the main gate. He had enough CERT team members show up at the main gate. About six of us. He wanted permission to let the six staff members in the jail to get back into that building that was on fire so we could rescue them staff members. And the Commissioner of Corrections was sitting at the main gate at the time, Mr. Owens, and Sergeant Beck's pleading with him, give me an order, sir, what to do. People are dying in there. Give me an order. It wouldn't issue an order. Sergeant Beck said, fuck it then. I'm opening this gate. This CERT team's going in. Sergeant Norris was in charge of the CERT team at that time, Edward Norris. And he laid down some chemicals and gave verbal directions to the inmates that were trying to give up to go over by the chapel. stay in the chapel area. If you're giving up, stay in the chapel area. But anybody on this sidewalk's going to be cut down. So we got down to the area where the control desk was. Inmates were on the roof, and they were about to kick in the windows to capture the 52 staff members on the roof. They yelled down to me, "Lockett, pass up that shotgun that I had." And I said, "Send something down." So they sent down a couple of belts, CO black belts. They sent a couple of belts down. And I said, "He's about 8 feet short. I can't reach." So they tied on an extension phone handle to the black belts. And I tied my shotgun on there, and I hoisted it up there. And I believe Sergeant Stokes had the shotgun. He wrapped around, he blasted a shot inside the building, and all the inmates scattered. Then we were able to enter the building and free them hostages up through the infirmary door. And once some 52 staff members made it to the main gate, again, a wise staff member would get in their car and go home at this point. And a lot of them did. They just drove right off. So I'm at the main gate. I know Mr. Eckenrode has been captured. I get on the phone. I call my wife. I said, "Go over to the Eckenrode's house. Ray's been captured. Get his two small children. Bring them back to our house. And I'll let you know if I can find them." And again, we had enough force to go back into the facility. And we just hold a little bit of the Zone 1 area. We took back just a little bit of the ground that night. I got on the radio, and an inmate was calling, "Inmate to control. I have a staff member we want to surrender. Critically injured staff member we want to surrender. Inmate to control." And I said, "That inmate can't be anywhere near us because the control desk is on fire already. It's already been firebombed. Well, it's heavy smoke damage, no fire got into it, but smoke damage."
Mm-hmm.
So I contacted Lieutenant Miller. "Lieutenant Miller, I got a radio. Inmates have about 12 of our radios, so it's really hard to communicate with anybody. Well, Lieutenant Miller, I have an inmate saying he wants to give up a staff member. What's your directions?" Lieutenant Miller says, have them inmates bring the staff member down to the barricade." So I communicate that to the inmates, told them bring them down to the barricade, which was at the E-Gate Tower area. We're over at the crosswalks area in front of Building 15.
Yeah.
And we stood there and we saw them. "Okay, put them, we're not coming to the barricade. You got to bring them on the other side of the barricade." That's what the lieutenant's direction was. So the inmates threw the unconscious officer off the barricade, lay down in front, and he laid down in front of the barricade. And I prayed to God that he would get up and run. I prayed. But he didn't get up. So he's a good 80 yards out from us. You know, it's a good distance between him and the safe spot. So I said to Tenet, "We gotta go get him." The inmate said, we're not coming across the barricade. We'll put him on the other side of the barricade, but we're not turning on the inmates. You know, it was obviously white inmates bringing a white officer out, and they didn't want to upset the other inmates, so they weren't going to carry him all the way to us. I said, "Lieutenant, we gotta, let's go get him. Let's go get him." And of about the 20 staff members there on the skirmish line, "Let's go get him, boys. Let's go get that. It's a CO, man. Let's go get it." Nobody would come. Nobody followed me. "Come on. We gotta get him." And I feared it was Mr. Eckenrode, that's what I thought. So one officer spoke up, "Rocket, I'll go with you." That was Sergeant Jeff Dietrich. And as you see at the time, I said, "I'll go with you, Rock." So I made the commitment with him, too, that I had a great time. So we ran over to a gauntlet of tools being thrown at us, rocks, fruit, saws, all kind of stuff, just bouncing off us. We're not feeling it. And we snatch him up, and we drag him back, and we get in front of the education building. Now, Mr. Eckenrode, he was a big fella. He was, that's why he was on my team. He was about 220 pounds, and me and Mr. Dietrich, we were both about 130 pounds. So we dragged Mr. Eckenrode to the front of the education building, where I feared that the inmates would charge over that barricade and come capture both of us. So I told Jeff, if that happens, just take the fuck off or stay here. At the same time, I'm waving to the guys at the skirmish line, come on up. We already drove them halfway back to the safe zone. Come on up. I'm waving to them. Come on up. Come on up. Get us. We need help. We're tired. Can't do it. And they wouldn't come. I don't know if Pitt and Miller ordered them to stay back there so no more staff would get captured or what. But all of a sudden, the biggest correction officer I ever saw kept running out. To me, I got this man. And he picked that officer up, put him on a cart, and we wheeled him to the main gate. That biggest correction officer I ever saw, he was a trainee, brand new, never even met him before. I'm in my almost fourth year there. His name was William Rhodes. Rhodes. He had the courage to charge out that line. As a trainee, a new hire. So we got Mr. Eckenrode to the main gate. I called my wife. I told him to take all of our children over to the Schwartz's family, as I made a commitment with Officer Schwartz also. Take all of our children to the Schwartz's family. You and Mrs. Eckenrode go down to the hospital. Ray's been beat up something horrible. And I went back in and railed out the night on the skirmish line till thousands of state troopers came with us till we began the assault on the next day. I do want to thank Officer Jeff Dietrich and trainee William Rhodes for heroic actions on that day.
Thank you for sharing this story.
I only ever tell that story about 5 or 6 times through my whole 30-year career. But Billy Rhodes is my guardian angel. Another time, many years later, I was severely injured at work. I had my wrist cut really bad. Billy Rhodes was there to give me first aid. You ever see Billy Rhodes? Did you do a phone interview with him?
I did a phone interview with him.
Oh, he's like, 6'5", 400 pounds of muscle. At the time, we were in our 20s back then.
Right. He mentioned you. He mentioned you running to save the hostage.
Yeah.
Quite a camaraderie among all of you officers.
So we're not personally friends, we're just co-workers. I got a small house, he don't fit through my front door, and I like small cars. I'm only 5'6", so. If you take him to dinner, he eats more than I eat in a week. In a meal. We're just co-workers. Can't say we had anything personal, but he's my guardian angel, that's for sure. There was 3 times that he saved me.
Wow.
I only told you about 2 of them.
When did you finally get to go home after all of that?
We had 6 severely damaged cell blocks.
Yeah.
And we had about, 1,200 inmates, maybe 1,500 inmates living on a field because they burned the trailers down that held 400 inmates. And then the 1,200 inmates in the cell blocks, they destroyed the doors. So they had to take the parts from, 1 or 2 of the cell blocks to make 1 or 2 good cell blocks.
Wow.
So we were pretty much, had to clean out the cell blocks is what the problem was, first of all, before you could repair them. So there was a lot of trash cleanup. for a couple of days. And fortunately, the weather held nice. It was nice weather. If it was cold nights, we would have been in big trouble.
Right. Wow.
And eventually, we put the inmates back in cells with no equipment for tour cells. How we had to manage it for a while.
And they were handcuffed and shackled to each other.
Yes.
In the cells.
They could still break out of the cells. See, it was kind of a false secret that the walls of the whole facility were hollow.
Right.
It was built to hold children. It wasn't built to hold a man.
Right.
So they saved money. They put hollow bricks in the whole place.
Wow.
So you could take your, you could rip your sink off the wall and smash it against the wall and let yourself out of the cell.
Wow. So let's move forward. And
so that's why we had to handcuff them and shackle them to the cells, because they could rip the, right then and there, they could rip the, that secret was out. That
right.
Probably was a maintenance secret for a number of years, but
wow.
Widely known now to the inmate population.
So, of course, if they're handcuffed to each other, it's a lot harder to move as a group of four or eight versus one person, right?
Correct.
So let's move forward now to the superintendent and the deputies have been let go.
Yes.
And how did the department and the institution, how did they rebuild the institution? How did that work?
Now, construction on the Camp Hill facility lasted about 25 years. Started actually in 1987 when they upgraded the power system. So almost my whole entire career at the Camp Hill facility was under construction or reconstruction.
Right.
So your question was, we lost all of our top administrators.
Yes.
And so we're a facility running on, I don't know, they assigned somebody temporary, you know? And you got to remember, a lot of your staff didn't come back. You know, your dedicated staff came back, but your other staff, they said it's too dangerous, and they went all out on sick leave. On. So, you know, all of your staff, you didn't have enough corrections officers for three shifts. You only had enough officers for two shifts. And then you had certain teams from other facilities fill in the staffing that you didn't have.
And that's why they went to the 12-hour shifts then as well.
Correct. You didn't, the whole second shift got wiped out of 3 days of rioting. You didn't have any second shift left. And anyone, like I said, a smart staff with a one home, you know, because you love your children, you shouldn't have to go through a work event like I had to go through. Shouldn't have to.
And then they brought in Superintendent Beard and Ken Kyler and John McCullough.
Yes, so Ken Kyler had a huge different philosophy than the last deputy. Now, Deputy Smith's philosophy was, as correctional staff, you'll never put your hands on inmates for any reason. And he made an example, I think in 1986, he fired eight RHU officers, devoted a few. He set the standard. There will be, while I'm Deputy Smith, there'll be no inmate assaults by staff. They weren't assaults by staff, or alleged abuse.
Right.
So he was firing staff. So the staff were afraid to protect themselves. I might get fired. Inmate assaults me, I gotta let them assault me, because if I fight back, the deputy may think I started the fight and fire me. I got a wife and kids. So Deputy Kyler had a different position on that. He says, no, you protect yourself. No wonder why this jail burned down. The staff didn't know they had the ability to protect themselves. He came from Huntington.
Right.
And they, you know, they had a little bit different rules in Huntington than he did at a friendly Camp Hill retreat.
And a couple of days actually before Camp Hill, Huntington had a pretty serious incident in one of their cell blocks, and they shut that down and took care of that right
immediately.
Away. Yeah.
Correct. They went in there. They know they couldn't go in there with weapons, but they wanted to staff safety. We went in there with weapons. No, we didn't use weapons.
Yeah.
We used negotiators.
Yeah.
So, and then Pittsburgh went off just a couple months before that also. It was three riots that year, Pittsburgh, Huntington, and Camp Hill.
And Rockview had a situation earlier that year as well. I talked to John McCullough about that as well. So there were like little powder kegs all over the state in our institutions at the time.
Correct. And here's what the... Right, so we all knew it was bound to blow up someday. So one of the offensive procedures Camp Hill took is we gave every staff member a whistle. Mm. That way, when something's going down, we'll know right where to respond to.
How'd that work out?
Naturally, during the riot, there was whistles blown all night long by the inmates that captured staff members. That didn't work out too well.
That must have been so eerie.
Now remember, take a note, we have a six-month disturbance in the Camp Hill RHU. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I did, yep.
April, I was involved in that incident. But go ahead to where you're at. We'd like to cover that one also.
Wow. So tell me what happened in the RHU.
Okay, we're holding all, we have all the rioters held in the Camp Hill RHU. We have two RHUs now because we had so many people we charged. We had, we were charging 300 inmates with riot-related charges. Mm-hmm. The RHU only holds 110 inmates.
Wow.
So we held the worst 110 inmates in the RHU. The one guy that was charged with the 52 counts of attempted murder. And after 6 months in the RHU, the inmates believed that they served enough RHU time. Because prior to the riot, you know, you would give up. If an inmate got assaulted a staff member, he got 90 days in the hole. But if you got a jail full of 2,000 inmates that are out of control and you only have 100 RHU cells, then you're probably letting them out in 20 days. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're cutting your time. Instead of doing 90 days for assaulting a staff member, we're going to let you out in 2 weeks. Because we need that bed for the next guy that assaults a staff member to go in.
Right.
So we're always giving them free breaks on the RHU time. And you could assume that most of the rioters were regular RHU clients through the years. Because they have a behavior problem.
Right.
So this time they were locked down for a six-month stretch steady. Steady, straight. They're not getting out until after your trial. That's going to be another 2 years. So they were upset. No, you can't hold us this long. It's okay to charge us, give us more street time, but not hold us in the RHU this long. So they ripped off the sinks in their cell, and they busted through the walls, again, because they were hollow, and then they started teaming up on each other. And when they got four or five other inmates together, then they busted out onto the tier. And not that they could get out of the building, but it's hard to go down the tier when they're throwing toilet pieces at you, and sink pieces, bricks at you, because there was no screens on the doors, they were open bars.
Right.
So that night, on the 12 at the 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift, we were forced to do 14 cell extractions.
Wow.
To stop that disturbance.
And so where did you put that?
They're not chemical cell extractions in those days. They are five-man team with a shield, pin the inmate to the back of the shield, and subdue him old-fashioned way.
Right. That must have been terrifying. So there you are 6 months after the worst experience that you've ever had, and it's like it's happening again.
The part that was terrifying was only the 10%, your best 10% of the officer corps works around the level 5 inmates. Okay, so I was proud to be identified in my second years as one of the best corrections officers. And then I was kind of upset that I had to ride out the next 2 years in the RHU with the people that abused my staff and stuff. It was a difficult time.
I can imagine. Wow.
Because the inmates were bragging which staff members they raped. They yelled out the cell doors, "We raped so-and-so. We're going to get you next. we did this to that. He cried like a baby. You know, you had to listen to crap like that. The victimizations of your staff members. But, you know, a couple of years later, life's better.
And of course, then they tore down those six original housing units and just rebuilt the facility. And you can talk about how that prison is nothing like it was back when the riot happened.
That is correct.
So how, what kind of changes?
Department of Corrections, by the time I went into the Department of Corrections, I was brand new. I didn't know anything about prisons, really. I didn't know it was my life goal to be a corrections officer. As a boy, I dreamed of being a corrections officer. It's the only job I ever had. And so I met my lifelong expectation. The Department of Corrections was a simple operation back in them days, but we were overcrowded. There was the war on drugs, I believe, and it just packed the facility to overflow capacity, and nobody had an answer how to control that.
I was talking with someone yesterday who worked in the statistics office at Central Office, and they were seeing a gain of 500 inmates a month leading up to this, and they were trying to tell people, we've got a problem, we've got a problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Correct. But we were, you know, the department was the Bureau of Corrections back then. It's a small agency, a little of a budget.
Yes.
Not really having any troubles, so nobody knows about you. So why give money to somebody you don't know about?
Right.
And the riot happened, and then they realized how badly we were way behind. I always take Commonwealth of Pennsylvania was the leader of the nation's correctional system. Mm-hmm. I always took pride in that fact.
Right.
And after the riot, we opened up and we had to invest a lot of money. And we came a long, long way. So I was very proud at the end of my career how far we came to get back on the top.
Yeah. Certainly did learn a lot from that terrible, terrible situation. And I'm so sorry that I'm making you go through all of this pain again.
No, that's okay. Not your fault.
It's very vivid.
I always regretted not being able to get up on a stage and tell Jeff Dietrich's heroic actions and Bill Rhodes.
Yeah, well, now you have. Because I'm going to take all of this, I'm going to transcribe it, share it with the archives, and it'll be over and collected and kept by the state forever.
All right. Well, thank you. That was my probably only regret I had.
Aww.
And I have one more. So I had to put in a lot of time after that. It was great difficulties. I had substance abuse issues. I was tremendously disciplined through my career. But I kept a smile on my face, and I was the rocket. So I role modeled professional behavior. And this is another touchy subject. I put myself in trouble with substance abuse after that.
Mm.
And I was fired.
Oh.
And the union won my job back.
Wow.
So I was a disgraced employee back at the Camp Hill facility. And one staff member helped me regain my professional bearing and stature. I want to thank her. Their name is Mary Rosa Lawless.
Oh.
I was a sergeant without a housing unit. And she was a new unit manager struggling. So I told her if she'd help me, I'd help her. I made a commitment with her. So, I was a substance abuser with the Department of Corrections, and I retired as a lieutenant. I'm thanking Mary Rosa Lawless.
Well, I'll make sure she hears this. And you know, don't be embarrassed or ashamed of that, because corrections is a hard job on everybody, and we all have our...
I can tell that story a lot about being terminated. I don't mind that story. I own that one.
Yeah. But, you know...
I own that.
Times are different now. I mean, substance abuse disorder is, you know... It's
prevalent in our field. I'm aware of that.
Yeah, it is.
And I acknowledge that. And, but, you know, the inmates called me the dope smoking lieutenant. The inmates in my facility, there's the dope smoking lieutenant. There's a man, he's got a white shirt because God has his back. You're true. You're right, man. God has my back. That's why I got a white shirt and I am the dope smoking lieutenant. How are you guys doing today?
Wow.
That's how I got to face that. So, well, I had to own that. I got fired as a substance abuser.
Wow.
But it's been an excellent career overall. And it was a career I picked out. I wanted it. I grew up wanting to be one, corrections officer. It's been great. When I was down, God sent Billy Rhodes and Mary Rosa Lomas to help me out.
There you go.
Okay, what back to your questions if you still have any.
Wow, I don't think I have any more. I just want to thank you so much for sharing your memories with me, because everybody that I talk to has their own different vantage points and perspectives, and as I talk to more people, they all connect, you know. I talked to Joe Miller, I talked to Bill Rhodes, now I've talked to you, I've talked to a couple people around the control center that second night, and so, you know, just amazing stuff that went on inside that fence that people didn't know.
That made the staff really tight for years and years as a bonded family. The ones that came back, you know, I still have problems with the staff that went home and came back a year or two later.
Right.
That didn't work that day.
Yeah.
That's what gets me.
Yeah.
But that's all it does.
That is. Good. Thank you so much. I want to thank you so much.